Hello and welcome back to the Archaeogeon News Weekly. I am, as ever, your lovable host, David Connolly. This news is brought to you in partnership between Stone Pages and the British Archaeological Jobs and Resources website. All the stories have been collected from various sources, and to view details on each story, including the source, please see the Stone Pages website at news.stonepages.com. And now the headlines from around the world are as follows. Stonehenge Visitor Centre looks cheap and nasty, say detractors. But archaeologists are happier with the architecture of Iron Age roundhouses that they've unearthed in Scotland. The oldest known fibre material is discovered in Georgia, while in Africa, giant Stone Age axes are found in Lake Basin in Botswana. Stone figurine is unearthed at Çatalhöyük in Turkey, while ancient Peruvian remains are uncovered across the world in South America. Excavations report from Cyprus, giving us a new view on the past, and an amazing fossil find in Georgia challenges theories on early humans. A Cumbrian museum in the UK acquires Bronze Age treasures, while we report on destruction at archaeological sites following the Dakar rally in South America. Ancient sites in Guernsey will have to be fenced off to protect them. And to finish off, are you sitting comfortably? Then I'll begin. Fairy tales have ancient origins. Denton Corker Marshall's designs for a £25 million Stonehenge visitor centre have been compared to an immigration detention centre just weeks before the planning application is due to be submitted. Following local consultation over the summer, the client, English Heritage, is hoping to submit plans to Wiltshire County Council by the end of this month. It aims to meet the government's target of opening the temporary facility in time for the influx of tourists attracted by London's 2012 Olympics. But in a sign that the 20-year Stonehenge Visitor Centre saga is set to continue, Councillor Paul Sample, a former mayor of Salisbury, has attacked the scheme as cheap and nasty addition to the World Heritage Site, while Peter Alexander Fitzgerald, a member of the International Council on Monuments and Sites, claimed the centre resembled a derelict aircraft hangar. Denton Corker Marshall has previously worked on plans for a £65 million scheme, but this was dropped in 2007 on cost grounds by the then Architecture Minister Margaret Hodge. She promised a world-class alternative would be created. Sample said, "It's cheap and nasty and is not going to do justice to the site. It looks like an immigration detention centre. It's not something that makes you feel something ancient and mystic. We should be building something to last. There should have been an international competition." Alexander Fitzgerald commented also that it looks like an IT student's first attempt at rendered graphics. Amateurish and causes you to wonder about the quality of the finished product. If you only get the detailed images at the time of the planning application, then you can't give a balanced critical opinion on the sustainability of the design. From this image alone, it's got to be a resounding no. An English Heritage spokesman said that the visitor centre would sit delicately on top of the landscape with minimal impact. Denton Corker Marshall, unfortunately, declined to comment. There's one thing that's good about Stonehenge, and I have to say it just seems to be the ongoing saga. One of the sad things is if you think about the millions, absolute tens of millions that have been spent so far on actually managing to work out, I don't know, nothing yet. It does make you worry for the heritage for the rest of Britain. I sincerely hope that they get something in place. Well, with happier architectural news, we move to Scotland. Archaeologists have uncovered the floor and timber beams of a 2,000-year-old roundhouse in the centre of a Moray farm. Experts believe the structure unearthed at Burnie was once the multi-story power centre of an Iron Age settlement. The archaeologist leading the excavation said it was the best preserved roundhouse discovered on the site. National Museums of Scotland curator Fraser Hunter said the huge building had a diameter of 50 feet and stood nearly 30 feet high, and showed how sophisticated the Iron Age settlers really were. The remains will be recorded before the timber is lifted carefully and then sent for analysis to gain insight into the type of wood used and how the house was built. The Burnie field has been excavated by archaeologists for the last 12 years, and Mr. Hunter said that the most significant discoveries have been five other roundhouses found this year. In a total, 20 roundhouses have been found on the site, and Sheila McCall, Elga Museum volunteer and archaeological representative of the Moray Society, which manages the museum, said the site had put Moray on the Iron Age map. It's another classic example of actually getting involved, field schools and volunteering in archaeology. This is one thing that I have to say that myself and people like Pastor Risens are actually promoting just now. And I think there's a greater awareness that this could be the way forward for archaeology. Anyway, good on you, Fraser. A team of archaeologists and paleobiologists have discovered flax fibres that are more than 34,000 years old, making them the oldest fibres known to have been used by humans. The fibres, discovered during systematic excavations in a cave in the Republic of Georgia, are described in this week's issue of Science. The flax, which have been collected from the wild and not farmed, could have been used to make linen and thread, the researchers say. The cloth and thread would then have been used to fashion garments for warmth, sew leather pieces together or tie together packs that might have aided the mobility from one camp to another. The microscopic research of the soil samples in which the numerous flax fibres were discovered was done by Eliso Kvadadze of the Institute of Paleobiology, part of the National Museums of Georgia. And a big apology if I've just said your name horribly wrong. Some of the fibres were twisted, indicating that they were used to make ropes or string. Others had been dyed black, grey, turquoise and even pink. Early humans used the plants in the area to colour the fabric or threads made from the flax. Today, the fibres are not visible to the eye because the garments and items sewed together with the flax have long ago disintegrated. The fibres were discovered, though, by examining samples of clay retrieved from different layers of the cave under a microscope. Elizabeth Barber, a retired professor from Occidental College in Los Angeles, says evidence of textiles already dates back 25,000 years, with impressions of woven material found in clay. It's now clear that the technology is even older and fits nicely with her hypothesis that plain old string was a powerful technology which helped people weather the last ice age. The scientist's original goal was to analyse tree pollen samples found inside the cave and study the environmental and temperature fluctuations of the course of thousands of years that would have affected the lives of the early humans. However, when they were looking for the pollen, they also discovered non-pollen polymorphs. That's flax fibres to you and me. They began excavating in the cave in 1996 and have returned every year since. So we'll wish them best of luck for future seasons. And if I may just say, let's roll on the cord age. A giant African lake basin is providing information about possible migration routes and hunting practices of early humans between 150 and 10,000 years ago. Oxford University researchers have unearthed new evidence from the lake basin in Botswana. They have documented thousands of stone tools on the lake bed, which sheds new light on how humans in Africa adapted to several substantial climate change events during the period that coincided with the last ice age in Europe. Researchers from the School of Geography and the Environment at the University of Oxford are studying the now dry basin of Lake Makgadigadi in Kalahari Desert. Their research was prompted by the discovery of the first of what are believed to be the world's largest stone tools on the bed of the lake. Although the first find was made in the 1990s, the discovery of four giant axes has not been scientifically reported until now. Four giant stone hand axes measuring over 30 centimetres long and of uncertain age were recovered from the lake basin. Equally remarkable is that the dry lake floor where they were found is also littered with tens of thousands of other smaller Stone Age tools and flakes. Professor David Thomas, head of the School of Geography and Environment at the University of Oxford, said that many of these tools were found on the dry lake floor, not around its edge, which challenges the view that big lakes were only attractive to humans when they were full of water. It's likely that the early human populations would have seen this area as a prolific hunting ground when food resources in the region were more concentrated than at times when the region's climate was wetter and food was more plentiful and the lake full of water. Co-researcher Dr. Sally Burrow has dated the sediment and shorelines of the lake basin, which has shown that the megalake was filled with water on multiple occasions in the last quarter of a million years. Professor Thomas commented that the interior of southern Africa has usually been seen as devoid of significant archaeology. Surprisingly, they have found and logged incredibly extensive Middle Stone Age artifacts spread over vast areas of the Lake Basin. The new research is the first time that the giant Botswanan Lake Basin in southern Africa has been the focus of scientific research, and these findings could prove new evidence to support the theory of hominid migration through and the expansion from Africa. New research beginning in 2010 and funded by the Leverhulme Trust will investigate possible links between the Lake Basin and the Zambezi River. A reclining man with a bushy beard and big nose is the latest to join a hall of stone figurines unearthed at the ancient site of Çatalhöyük in Turkey. The sculpture, which measures just 6 inches high, was uncovered at the Neolithic site last week. Çatalhöyük was the final resting place of the world's first farmers. Other figurines representing farmyard animals and people in sitting and standing positions have already been excavated at the site, which dates back to the dawn of farming some 9,000 years ago. Archaeologists working on the site have discovered houses with rooms decorated with vulture skulls, wild boar tusks and teeth from weasels and foxes. Some of the buildings are believed to have humans buried beneath them. The discovery of female figurines at Çatalhöyük originally led anthropologists to speculate that the community worshipped mother goddesses, but other experts say that these astonishing Stone Age statues may have just been the world's first educational toys. They say that the mother goddess figurines, which were buried amongst rubbish of the Stone Age, are unlikely to have been religious icons. Many of the figures, thought to have been women in the 1960s, are just as likely to be men. Archaeologist Professor Lynn Meskell of Stanford University said that the majority are cattle or sheep and goats. They could be representative of the animals that they were actually dealing with, and they may have been teaching aids. All were found in midden deposits, and not in niches or platforms, or even placed in burials. Out of the 2,000 figurines so far dug out of the site, less than 5% of them are female, she told the British Science Festival in Surrey University, Guildford, this week. Çatalhöyük survived for around 2,000 years, and I have to add that with the wealth of evidence coming out of this carefully excavated site, it may actually take that long to complete the research. A joint Japanese-Peruvian archaeological mission has uncovered the remains of a pre-Incan woman sacrificed more than 2,000 years ago in the Andean nation. The bones were discovered in a fetal position, with the legs bound by a cord that had been preserved despite the passage of centuries. The remains were uncovered at an archaeological complex in northern Peru's Cajamarca department, where several previous discoveries of the ancient remains have been made. Named the Lady of Pacopampa after the site in the northern highlands where she was found, she's 1.55 metres tall and was surrounded in her tomb with several gold artefacts, including pendants, necklaces and plates. The woman, who was between 30 and 40 years old, lived around 800 to 900 years BCE, which would make the Lady of Pacopampa considerably older than most excavated and mummified bodies found in Peru. The Cypriot Department of Antiquities announced the completion of the 2009 Prastion Mesorotsos project that took place from the 22nd of June to the 30th of July and involved investigation of stratified remains of Neolithic and Chalcolithic periods, Bronze Age, Iron Age, Late Antique and even medieval archaeology. Excavations were carried out in 8 areas across the circa 10-hectare site in the Paphos district. In total, over 100 meters square were exposed, and architecture and features from multiple periods were revealed. The first season of excavation has confirmed the presence of deeply stratified, and that at present is 1.5 meters plus, occupation at the site, which may eventually shed light on a series of important social changes that occurred, including the transition from the Neolithic into the Chalcolithic period. Particularly encouraging was the presence of Middle Cypriot Bronze Age architecture, which is situated in the same location where Early Cypriot Bronze Age and Late Chalcolithic material are being found, which could eventually lead to a stratified sequence throughout all these important periods. equally important is the apparent abandonment of the site in the Middle Cypriot III period, which coincides with the growing importance of Palipaphos as a regional centre of Western Cyprus. Excuse me. Understanding and dating the abandonment of the Prastion Mesorotsos could tell us more of when and why Palipaphos came to be such an important place in the Late Bronze Age. After the tumultuous end of the Late Bronze Age, the site of Prastion Mesorotsos was reoccupied in the Iron Age and continued to be the focus of inhabitation and activity until relatively recently, as shown by the excavation of substantial medieval remains and a large threshing floor. Continued excavation at the site may provide valuable information on social changes through time and provide an important perspective on the changing way of life in Western Cyprus. Well, we'll keep an eye out on this one, and I have to say again, good luck to all our friends in Cyprus who are involved in archaeology there. Returning to Georgia now, the conventional view of human evolution and how early man colonized the world has been thrown into doubt by a series of stunning paleontological discoveries suggesting that Africa was not the sole cradle of mankind. Scientists in the Republic of Georgia have unearthed remains of five primitive humans that date back to 1.8 million years ago, suggesting some of our oldest ancestors lived in the region at that time. The partial skeletons, which represent the earliest humans discovered outside Africa, challenge the theory that our ancestors evolved entirely on the continent and left the cradle of humanity only 60,000 years ago. David Lord Kubinidze, director of the Georgian National Museum, said the primitive humans were short, with small brains and strongly developed legs. The fossils are thought to be early Homo erectus, a forerunner of the modern human, which lived in Africa 2 million years ago. Lord Kubinidze said that some Homo erectus may have left Africa for Eurasia before returning much, much later. The fossils were uncovered at the Damansi archaeological site, southwest of the Georgian capital of Tbilisi, in the foothills of the Caucasus. The skulls, jawbones and fragments of limb bones, thought to belong to two males and three females, were found next to stone tools and animal bones that bore cut marks, suggesting that the species also prepared meat for food. Chris Stringer, head of the human origins at the National History Museum in London, said that the Damansi fossils are extremely important in showing us a very primitive stage in the evolution of Homo erectus, and they raise important questions about where that species originated. Speaking again at the British Science Festival in Guildford, where Lord Kubinidze gave the British Council lecture, he raised the prospect that Homo erectus may have evolved in Eurasia from the more primitive-looking Damansi population, and then migrated back to Africa to eventually give rise to our own species, Homo sapiens. The only human fossil to predate the Damansi specimens are of an archaic species of Homo habilis, which is only found in Africa, which used simple stone tools and lived between 2.5 million and 1.6 million years ago. If we'd found the Damansi fossils 40 years ago, they would have been classified as Homo habilis because of their small brain size. Their brow ridges, though, are not as thick as classical Homo erectus, but their teeth are more like Homo erectus. They also stated that Georgia is, and this is quite a wild statement, the cradle of the first European. Additionally, one of the five skulls is of a person who lost all or his or her teeth during their lifetime, but had still survived for many years despite being completely toothless. This suggests some kind of social organization based on mutual care. So I hope I get the same treatment when I lose mine. This, however, is one of the joys of archaeology, where a single site and even a single find can change everything. A rare Bronze Age find, the first of its type in the UK for nearly 100 years, has been acquired by Tully House Museum in Carlisle, up in Cumbria, England. It's a section of a necklace which was found in Brampton last year by a metal detector enthusiast. The museum passed on to the Portable Antiquities Scheme, who recognised it as a terminal for an early Bronze Age lunula. It was therefore found to be treasure, and then went to the British Museum for valuation. Tully House was then given the first opportunity to acquire it as part of the treasure process. The item comes from one end of a crescent-shaped gold necklace. These were christened Lunula in the 18th century because of their similarity to crescent moons. It's made of sheet gold with expanded terminals linked together behind the neck, and they're very common in Ireland, where more than 85 have been found. They are, however, much less common in Britain, where only about 12 are known. They tend to be found in western areas, including Cornwall, Scotland and Wales. Tim Padley, Tully House Keeper of Archaeology, said that it shows these high-status objects were being used in Cumbria, and also shows there was some kind of connection between Cumbria and both Scotland and Ireland around 1900 BCE. This could have been trade or exchange of ideas or gifts. Tully House is very glad to acquire the object, which is an important addition to its prehistoric displays. And again, if I can just say, we're actually very glad they've got it too. Irreversible damage to a number of important archaeological sites in Chile and Argentina has been caused by the Dakar Rally, an annual off-road automobile race held in South America for the first time in January this year. In spite of persistent warnings from archaeologists and environmentalists both before and during the event, the extent of the damage emerged from a report submitted to the Chilean government by the National Monuments Council in early July. Expanding on preliminary findings published after the race in February, the report, extracts of which were published in the Santiago Times, claims that irredeemable damage sustained at six archaeological sites could have been avoided if recommendations issued by the council in 2008 had been followed. The response to the rally in South America has been very positive, with plans already underway for a repeat run in 2010. It was also claimed that the rally brought a total of $74 million worth in sales and profits to Chile and Argentina. Most of the archaeologists and environmentalists who have voiced their concerns about the rally have accepted that cancellation is an unlikely prospect, and that the threat to sites can best be minimised by ensuring that the route is thoroughly surveyed beforehand in close cooperation with the organisers. According to the National Monuments Council report, four of the sites that sustained damage are in the region of the Atacama and two are in the region of Coquimbo. The report focused specifically on Pelican Creek near the town of La Higuera in Coquimbo, where a team of council archaeologists discovered a pre-Columbian hunter-gatherer camp, half of which has been destroyed by the race. The vehicles destroyed stone implements such as knives and arrowheads, spear points and scrapers, as well as fragments of ceramics and shells, human bones and even a rock structure dating to 9000 BCE. According to Oscar Acuna, the executive secretary of the council, only 120 kilometres, or 10% of the route, has actually been inspected, and it's possible that more instances of damage could emerge. Chilean rally driver Rodrigo Ilanes said that although a strong code of ethics prevented them from going near the geoglyphs and other known archaeological sites, there are often no indications of where these sites actually are, and it was of great importance that they should be mapped out before the next rally. Concerns have also been raised that the geoglyphs might be threatened by mining in the region, and the National Monuments Council has announced an investigation to determine if this is indeed the case. It's what you don't know that seems to be that's most under threat, so perhaps I could actually put a call out to the rally organisers to properly fund a survey before the next rally. Then we'll get the best of both worlds, where we'll actually find more archaeology and the rally will be able to go ahead as well. Just a thought. And more damage, I'm afraid. An ancient monument in Guernsey could be fenced off because of repeated antisocial behaviour. The Culture and Leisure Department has applied for planning permission to put a fence around the Kists in Circle at Sandy Hook in St. Sampson's. It said that fly-tipping, littering, fires and even moving the stones had all been problems at the site for years and were the reason for the application. The site, which was excavated back in 1912, dates to around 2,500 to 18,000 BCE. The plans include a gate which would allow access to the site, but only with the use of a key that would be held at the Guernsey Museum. The museum operates a similar system for several other sites. If the plans are approved, archaeologists and historical site staff will work to restore the ancient monument. It is such a shame that to protect an archaeological site, you have to fence it off and lock the gate. And finally, a study by anthropologists has explored the origins of folk tales and traced the relationship between variants of the stories recounted by cultures around the world. The researchers adopted techniques used by biologists to create the taxonomic tree of life, which shows how every species comes from a common ancestor. Dr. Jamie Terani, a cultural anthropologist at Durham University, studied 35 versions of the Little Red Riding Hood story from around the world. Contrary to the view that the tale originated in France, shortly before Charles Perrault produced the first written version in the 17th century, Dr. Terani found the variants shared a common ancestor dating back more than 2,600 years. He said that over time these folk tales had been subtly changed and evolved just like a biological organism. Because many of them were not written down until much, much later, they have been misremembered or reinvented through hundreds of generations. By looking at how these folk tales have spread and changed, it tells us something about human psychology and what sort of things we find memorable. The oldest tale was found was an Aesopic fable that dated from around the 6th century BCE. So the last common ancestor of all these tales clearly predates this. Dr. Terani, who presented his work on Tuesday this week at the British Science Festival in Guildford, Surrey, identified 70 variables in plot and characters between different versions of Little Red Riding Hood. He found that the stories could be grouped into distinct families according to how they evolved over time. Professor Jack Zips, a retired professor of German at the University of Minnesota, who is an expert on fairy tales and their origins, described the work as exciting. He believes folk tales may have helped people to pass on tips for survival to new generations. He said that the Little Red Riding Hood tale was about violation and rape, and suspects that humans were just as violent in 600 BC as they are today, so that they will have exchanged tales about these types of violent acts. Nice to know that we are just the same as we were in the past, but it's also sad to know as well. Not a fairy tale. We have some real stories here. Preservation Today Network. If you haven't been along to them yet, I would highly recommend you go along to this amazing site at www.voicesofthepast.org. And if you're wanting some other amazing tales, then we've got two from Past Horizons. Again, if you go along to the pasthorizons.com website, you can have a look at the free, and yes, you heard it there, free online magazine about adventures in archaeology for volunteers. And why not also have a look at the Past Horizons blog, which is always up to date with new and exciting stories. Can I also remind you that they may not be exciting, but they are new, archaeological and heritage employment opportunities, as well as the UK Heritage Calendar and the burgeoning and exciting Badger Federation. You can find that at www.bajr.org and www.bajrfed.co.uk. Remember, you can always find more at Stonepages, news.stonepages.com. And just one last little nugget for you. Last Saturday, I was working with the Edinburgh Archaeological Field Society on one of the Scottish Archaeology Month projects that's taking place all this month across Scotland. And we were in search of a 12th century chapel. Where are we going to find it? Well, we actually did. We found the foundations, and not just the foundations, but fortunately actually the first plinth level of the chapel, where it curves into what looks like an apsidal end. That's a sort of a rounded end, if you want. And this Saturday, we are off again in search of, yes, you guessed it, another 12th century chapel. Or nunnery, we don't know yet. We're going back to do geophysics and a little bit of test trenching around the small village of Cowsland near Edinburgh. So I'll hopefully report back to you next week telling you what we found. Archaeology is, as they say, an adventure. So come back to us again next week to find out what's being told around the world.